sir. All right, that's going to do it. Here comes Nancy. Now we can start. Okay. All right, so it turns out Judith was a bouncer in a previous career. All right. All right, let's go ahead and get started. The second part of the program really focuses on some pretty big changes that have happened at the state level. I had a comment from in the very back row that we need to all speak into our mics a little better. Am I doing okay now? All right, good deal. Okay, we'll all do that, speak right into the mic. So we've got big changes that came to the RTP in the last round, and we just talked about that in some detail. Right now we're going to focus on a couple of changes that came to the transportation planning rule and also to the Oregon Highway Plan last December, when both commissions went through fairly significant changes. Oh, I hate seeing that screen up there. Mm-hmm. We're all going to thank IT for making these automated updates happen. And then after that, we'll go through the virus scan, okay? So this should just be a couple hours here. Slides are in your packet. Are they on a thumb drive? I could always yank the cord and plug my computer in if you want to bail. I've got my computer here. All right, so I'll tell you a little bit more about what you're about to see on these slides. So last year, the Transportation Planning Rule went through an update to address the kinds of issues we face in all those 2040 town centers and regional centers and main streets that are part of your local plans when you have everything coming together in one spot. And so that's what we're going to hear a little bit about today in terms of the multimodal mixed-use areas. That's going to be, I guess, the first part of this. Is that right, Bill? That's the first part of the presentation. So Bill Holmstrom is going to give that part of the presentation. Did I flip that? Okay. And then so Eric's going to start out. Eric Havig from ODOT's going to start with the highway plan component of that. And they're not going to cover everything today. The goal is to hit the things that really are relevant to local TSPs and the planning we're doing here in the region. Okay, we're going to go to karaoke mode here pretty soon. Mm-hmm. Got the slides. Okay, let's go ahead and have Eric start then with the paper slides here. Does everybody see that in your packet? So take a look. You'll see.
Can everybody hear me back there? Okay. Again, Eric Havig. I'm with the Department of Transportation. I'm the planning section manager. I'm sorry you get second fiddle for this presentation. Michael Rock is really our expert, but Michael and his wife felt it necessary to have their third baby last week, so he's not able to make it, but glad to report mom and dad and baby are all doing great, so I get to do the presentation. We are going to focus on a couple areas of the Oregon Highway Plan revisions. Back in 2011, the legislature, working closely with the department, said, ODOT, you need to make changes to your Oregon Highway Plan around mobility standards, and then gave specific instructions of what those changes are. And at the same time, turned to Department of Land Conservation and Development and said, we need some changes to the TPR, but these things have to be compatible and work together. So we'll be tag-teaming with Bill to try to show how these pieces fit together. Really, there was two main themes that came out of the legislation and the concerns that we heard at both state agencies around issues with the highway plan mobility standards, as well as the TPR, about how implementation of Section 0060 was occurring for communities and economic development. The first was that economic development objectives needed to be better balanced with transportation, that transportation was being viewed as more of the hammer to creating good jobs and opportunity, and we need to kind of think more holistically, think about broad objectives, considerations in making our decision making. The second one is it's too difficult to make increases to density occur, even though we have all these state goals and policies around compact, mixed-use areas. When we try to actually make those happen in our communities, transportation seems to be one of those issues that are holding those up. So those are kind of the themes. And as we started working through these things, we took in a lot of stakeholder input, a lot of stakeholder perspective. Okay, just slide. There we go. And out of a joint group, working group between DLCD, or LCDC, and our Oregon Transportation Commission, we issued a joint subcommittee report that said, here are the areas that we need to focus on. Those focus areas then became part of legislation with the 2011 legislation passed in Senate Bill 795 that instructed the changes to the TPR as well as the Oregon Highway Plan. So, many of the applications around the Oregon Highway Plan are partially new, partially not new. We've always had the ability to do alternative mobility targets or mobility standards. But what we've really done in our policy is kind of change the context, change the mind frame, change the starting point of the conversation, try to build in multiple objectives into your decision-making process, not just like I think Livine was saying it up here, not a single-minded on just highway or vehicular mobility, but thinking about mobility of the system differently. And so we're going to focus on what we've learned so far in setting mobility targets and what those mean. We're also going to focus on small increases in traffic, because that really ties very closely to some of the issues around implementation of the TPR. We'll try to get into a few case studies, but we don't have a whole lot so far on that. So the first item, on the mobility plan. First of all, the highway plan. One more, John. The highway plan is a state modal plan. So this is an umbrella, or it's under the umbrella of the Oregon Transportation Plan. The highway plan sets out what are the policy and objectives for the state highway transportation system. So that's one of those modal plan elements. It sets up what are those policy actions that we need to think about from a strategic planning perspective of planning a system, a highway system, that's going to be functional and integrated, and think about how the highway functions integrate with bike, ped, transit, community design, economic development, livability, environment, all those factors and how they work together. Policy 1F is the specific policy within the highway plan that talks about the mobility standards. So that's the policy that's been revised, not the entire highway plan policies, just policy 1F. So, in the policy background, one of the key things that was in the legislation was how do we do this balance? I think even the panel members, as we were starting to kind of talk about some of the subjective nature of coming up with those balance criteria, this is also embedded in our policy document around policy 1F. It's not a formula. That's probably one of the biggest things that would come out of this. It's more setting up the conversation that can occur and needs to occur between communities, stakeholders, citizens, business interests, as well as state transportation and local transportation advocates. How do you bring all those perspectives together and balance all these issues out? The policy doesn't say how to do that. It just says you need to think about more things than highway mobility. This is a pretty substantial change, because if you read the old policy 1F, it was very highway-centric and very focused on vehicular mobility. And the changes here are a little bit different. We want to focus on the system planning. The real key here is how do we set up the mobility expectations for the system in a system context. We don't want to be thinking about just an individual intersection or even a short corridor, but a broad community. At a system plan level, a TSP, an RTP, broad mobility corridors that I think you're looking at here in the Portland metro area, that's really the scale that these really come into play. And then I'll focus on the small increases next as well. So alternative mobility targets. The first change in the policy is it's no longer alternative mobility standards. This didn't seem like that big of a change to some of us in the department, but it's turned out to actually be a pretty significant change. Going away from a hard and fast standard to more of a target really is done from one key standpoint. How do we change the context of the conversation from an artificial number you need to achieve versus a goal and objective? What can you do thinking about mobility strategically on your system? It's more of an outcome of the process rather than an input into the process. And that's a major change, because when you think about some of your older TSPs, you started doing exactly like Lydia was talking about. You run your model, figure out what your system needs are, and then you compare to, do we meet the standard? If we don't meet the standard, what are all the infrastructure things we need to put in place to meet the standard? What this is trying to say is, here's the target, here's what you want to achieve, but let's bring in all these other objectives, goals, perspectives, and what can we actually achieve at the end? So it's more of an outcome decision of the process than an input to it. We've changed some of the volume to capacity targets as well. One of the things we realized is back in 1999, things were different than it was in 2012. Growth has occurred, money hasn't kept up with inflation. The system is just not operating the same level it was. So recognizing that congestion has occurred, we modified some of the existing tables for a lot of our urban areas and recognized that congestion has raised. We need to be more commensurate with what realistic conditions were on the system. We need to come up with alternatives other than volume to capacity. I'll talk a little bit about this a little bit later and probably call on Libby to talk about some of the research that's been going on in this. The hard part here with coming up with different measures is exactly the conversation I think we were hearing earlier. There's a lot of different ideas. How do you measure it? What are the data needs? How is it going to be applicable in system planning versus dealing with TPR 0060 issues? And then some of the policy assessment I'll try to get to as well. So developing alternative mobility targets. We have had in place in ODOT some guidelines on how to do this. Even though the 1999 highway plan has talked about alternative mobility targets, it took us to about 2009 to really put some guidelines together about how to even have these conversations. And of course, as soon as we get the guidelines put together, the policy changes. So now we have to go back and redo these. And Darcy Ruzicki is working with us very closely on the policy implementation and the guidelines piece with this. But the guidelines are still applicable in a lot of ways because it talks about the theoretical discussions that need to occur and it's the communication and the coordination aspect of setting these targets. Again, it's the outcome of the process, and that was already built into those standards. So when do you need to do an alternate mobility target? If we have high seasonal traffic. I believe one of the panel members, Carl, was talking about coast. US 101. We have high coastal traffic conditions. We need to think about mobility targets. Does it make sense to try to provide for a high level of mobility during the peak 3 months out of the year? Sisters, Oregon is another great example. In the summer months, the traffic spikes about 40% over what it is on average annual traffic conditions. So seasonal adjustments and variations. Where we have severe environmental conditions, we just can't build our way out of it. We're up against a wetland. We have a creek. We have a river. We got a cliff, whatever that is, thinking about the environmental impacts. I think this is also talking now broader about environment, thinking about environmental health issues, thinking about greenhouse gas emissions, and how do those kind of factor into your overall system planning. Again, we've talked about balancing multiple objectives. It's not just highway mobility. It's not just vehicular mobility. It's system mobility. And then financial limitations. Lidvine really hit on this. We just don't have the money. We haven't had the money. I would argue that a lot of our system plans that we put together in the mid to late 90s, a little bit of flight fiction is maybe the term I would use. Thinking about here's the system needs we really want to have but never really bringing in the discipline. Is that feasible? Is that likely? Do we even have the kind of money necessary to build that system? If not, maybe we should focus our limited resources on those things that are going to be most important, add the most value to our system in the long term. So we're making sure our money is spent as wise as possible. But financial limitations are the reason to do that as well. So when we consider them, we want to consider them really at the system planning. That's where this conversation needs to occur. When you're starting to think about what is the local street system and how does that all work together, again, one of our panel members said it doesn't make sense to think about the state highway system outside of the context of the local system. We fully agree with that. It needs to be one integrated transportation system. People move around in your communities, whether it's on a local road, a county road, or a state highway, it doesn't matter. They need to get to destinations. They need to get to their jobs, get kids to games, get to the supermarket shopping. Whatever it is, we need to have an integrated system. So how does the local street and the multimodal network fit within the state highway? How do we manage that system? Thinking about transportation demand management, operations. I think up here you call it TISMO. Is that the acronym? Okay. TISMO program, ITS. So what are the various demand management and operations kind of programs we can bring together for thinking about how the system is going to work, not just infrastructure investment, but also plans and policy changes. And then thinking about the land use. What is going to be the overall land use goals and objectives? Where's your comprehensive plan going? What kind of goals do you have around economic development, freight mobility, factoring all of those things into the conversation? One of the key things out of this process, it's not hidden. It's not done in a vacuum. This is meant to be transparent. It needs to be a public process. We need the stakeholders at the table working with us, talking about the trade-offs. So as we start talking values and perspectives, again, some of these are very subjective. People are going to have different perspectives. We want that holistic conversation to occur to make sure this is an open and honest dialogue. Think about corridor consistency. I'll use the coast as an example. Some of my previous work has been done in Region 2, so I work a lot of coastal communities. If we're starting to think about alternative mobility targets up and down the coast, does it make sense that we have one kind of measure in Astoria and then go to a different kind of measure in Seaside and then have another measure down in Tillamook? And you can see on and up and down the line. So trying to think from a corridor construct, come up with something that has some consistency in application, because we don't want to be trying to go up and down, figuring out which community I'm in, how am I going to come up with what the measure is. Incorporation of appropriate actions. So anytime we set up what this target is, it's really forming that agreement, that expectation. That's really one of the goals to us out of this process, is trying to lock down an agreement with the local government. How do we expect the system to perform over the planning horizon? And then how can we manage to that? To make that happen, there needs to be actions on the local side, whether that's codes and policies and ordinance language to support that, land use action changes, funding planning scenarios. How do we make sure we're prioritizing those projects and working together that those things will come into the system and online in a strategic fashion? So what kind of local actions? And then this last piece is, how do we try to tie what we do in planning to design? This has been probably one of my biggest frustrations as an engineer for a long time. We've spent a lot of time setting up the expectation, and then we come in to design the project, and all of a sudden we have a different set of expectations. We're trying to actually work with FHWA to see if we can get to a point of agreement that where we've gone through this alternate mobility process and set the expectation with the community, that becomes the expectation for design as well. So we don't have to come back and revisit those expectations that we set during the planning process. This is a huge step. We're not quite there, but we're actually starting to gain some momentum.
Okay, thank you. My question has to do with the connectivity between those cities. Is that part of the consistency in your plan?
It really should be. And as we worked with Seaside and currently working with Astoria, one of the things that we really wanted to do from the region is work with our Area Commission on Transportation. So they understand if we set a certain mobility target for Seaside, how is that going to affect Cannon Beach to the south? How is that going to affect Astoria to the north? Because there are goods and services as well as people that need to move through those communities, not just into those communities. So that's another part of the conversation. I mean, we have some definite goals and objectives inside the community, but still trying to maintain some regional connectivity, regional system functionality, and that we felt that the Area Commission, at least in the coastal communities, would provide that forum. I think here you got, between JPAC and Metro, you got a much bigger conversation to have with that as well.
And actually, Eric, on that point, you've actually processed a Seaside amendment. I can't remember how the vehicle was, but you have an amendment for Seaside that went through the commission about a year ago. Is that right?
That is correct.
Is that a case study of using this new policy?
It is a case study, and I'll try to get to it. It's a little bit later in the presentation.
All right, okay, thank you.
So what can alternate mobility targets look like? Well, the first thing is most of our standards that exist today are based upon volume to capacity. Living hit on this. There's some reasons why we have volume to capacity. It's easy to calculate. It's easy to understand. You don't need a whole lot of data and big models to kind of predict it. And it gives you a pretty good indicator of how the system is performing under a lot of conditions. Not all, but under a lot. So one of the simple things you can do is just change the number. You know, if you have a target volume to capacity of 0.85, so 85% of capacity, maybe 95% or 0.95 makes sense. Or is it 1.0? Once you get up to that at-capacity condition, now you have to start looking a little bit different. So maybe you start thinking about duration. How many hours of at-capacity conditions are you going to operate? What makes sense there? What about time of year, time of day? If you're in an area that has high seasonal traffic, why would you want to set your standard for the peak 3 months out of the year where the traffic is 40%? Maybe you go back to annual average. As your basis, and you bring everything back to a common set baseline. Or do we just come up with a new measure altogether? And that's really the question I know this area is wrestling with. Volume to capacity, we can probably look at some of your major routes. 13 hours in 20 years is probably not outside the realm of possibility or even probability for at-capacity conditions on some of the major travel ways. So does it make sense to have a volume to capacity measure for that many hours of congestion, or do we think about something different, whether it's travel time, reliability? I know there's a lot of different concepts hanging out there. The difficulty, again, is how do you come up with a measure that you can explain, people can understand, you can measure, you can replicate, and that doesn't take a whole lot of energy and data to always manipulate or come up with that? Because that, I think Judith was talking about the cost of being able to do this. That's an important factor. I have no answers, but we at least have the opportunity to talk about it. So, examples. So one of the first examples that, that I'll talk about is the City of Seaside Transportation System Plan. City of Seaside, about 8-9 years ago, we had a major project planned for their city. We were going to be widening US 101. From a 2- and a 3-lane facility to a 5-lane facility. We had money all lined up for the first phase of the project. And the community got together and said, this is not the project for our community. They voted down the project. Said, we don't want this for the City of Seaside. We said, okay, that's fine. The money went elsewhere. We'll come back and work with you on a system plan update when you're ready. And as soon as we started getting into the system plan, we followed through with our normal process. And lo and behold, if we just stick to our normal process, guess what project was coming up as the way to solve the problem? The same project that they had just voted down. That wasn't going to get us anywhere because that wasn't going to meet their multiple objectives, their considerations. So we all stepped back and said, what are we trying to achieve here? What do you need to have to be a successful community on the coast? Their issue is more about how do we have connectivity east-west across the highway? How do we improve our bicycle and pedestrian circulation network so people can walk around our community more effectively? The vast majority of the streets didn't even have sidewalks or any kind of paved shoulders. So they were really focusing on other options. They wanted to talk about how their local road network can provide north-south routes to the highway so their local traffic can actually travel two destinations within the community without having to get onto US 101. These were all really great ideas. We were all supportive of this. So once we brought all those together and sat down and said, what can we actually do? What's reasonable? What are the priorities? The outcome out of this was more of, here's where we're at. This is the best we can afford to do around transportation and Seaside. And we ended up setting an alternate mobility standard or target for the City of Seaside that at average annual conditions, because we wanted to take out that peaking characteristics. It made no sense there in Seaside. We are going to have, at the main intersection, if you know Seaside, Broadway, and US 101 is the main intersection in town, 3 hours of at-capacity conditions on average average conditions. The rest of the system operates at capacity or below during average conditions. So we just set the target to be at capacity for 1 hour. So it's a very simple measure. We didn't come up with anything really hard to measure. The data and information is very accessible and easy to get to, and it has a sensitivity and applicability, so when they're looking at comprehensive plan changes, we can kind of figure out, are we still meeting our expectation of performance? And if not, then do we need to get back together and reset what that expectation is? That's really the goal. Here in the Portland metro area, I know there's a lot of discussion through the RTP about different performance measures. Our Region 1 office is really starting to look into doing some research around what kind of measures make sense. What I'll tell you, there's no silver bullet. I wish there was. This is not an easy thing to do. There's a lot of different values. So how do you try to bring those values into play, into a performance measure that, again, meets those goals and objectives, but still is doable, practical, consistent, doesn't create a lot of administrative work and cost to manage. Another place we're really seeing our alternate mobility targets come into play is around our interchanges. Knowing that interchanges are a vital link for systems and communities about how they're going to grow, so how do we make sure the system performance is maintained and the safety? Setting that bar through IAMS is another opportunity. Earlier we were talking about the Shemawa Road interchanges, one that we've just recently done down in Region 2, where that process set up. What is the expectation for transportation infrastructure? And if we don't have the money, let's acknowledge we don't have the money, and we'll plan for our system under that. That's how we're going to manage it. We're going to manage it to a different level of expectation. We also have other interchanges where we just put an interchange in that's in a more rural area where we know we have a lot of excess capacity. We don't want to see that excess capacity used up. We can actually go the other way and set a target that reserves that capacity for longer-term future growth. So it doesn't always have to work one direction. And we're also working with a lot of communities about alternate mobility targets right now. So just kind of summary of the alternate mobility targets, really the function here and the purpose is our commitment to work with you to establish what is reasonable, feasible, prudent, what makes sense, because the outcome needs to be an agreement between you and the state about how is the system going to perform? How are we going to work together in partnership to manage those facilities for this set of expected growth, for this set of expected outcomes? It doesn't mean that things can't change. The world changes. We understand that. So when that happens, it just means let's get back together and talk about how does the changing world now affect those set of expectations, and do we need to adjust to it? We know we're not going to have enough money to build our way out, but we can at least work together to make sure we're planning and organizing and strategically investing in the system to make the investments last as long as possible and make sure they're going towards the highest and best needs. So really that's what this is all about, from our policy change, trying to flip that paradigm, flip the conversation from a standard, you must meet, target, goal, conversation, outcome. So any questions on mobility targets before I talk small increases in traffic? Wow, I've bored you to death. Yes.
Seaside. Thanks, Tom. So in Seaside, you talked about altering the mobility standards and in one way, let's say, adopting a different performance standard. Also, addressing the circulation systems within the city for all modes.
Right.
I didn't hear you talk about addressing the statewide function of 101 through Seaside and addressing in August when those long queues develop from that key intersection that you were talking about.
What we really came to the decision of setting those expectations around the local system, their land use, their goals and plan. Again, the outcome was how is the system going to perform? We know we're not going to widen US 101 to 5 lanes, but can we do some strategic investments to 101 to minimize those August effects? And that's what we targeted. We targeted some operational changes to some of the interchanges, a couple of short sections where we can actually get a 4-lane highway in without very, very much impact to the community. And again, trying to improve the north-south alternate routes to handle as much traffic as possible for local travel as well as some of the tourist travel. There's actually a pretty good north-south parallel system on both sides of the highway. And part of the biggest issue is trying to get over the not in my backyard for some of the folks that live on those routes, understanding that this is actually a good thing. If we, you know, improve these routes, it's easier for them to move around their community. It's safer to move around their community. And if we improve the connections, the east-west connections, again, they have multiple opportunities. It doesn't mean we're not going to have congestion. I mean, that was one of the things we accepted out of this process, is US 101 in the summer will have congestion. If you try to go through Seaside today during the Hood to Coast run when everything's pretty much tied up, that's probably what you're going to experience in Seaside in 20 years on some of the normal summer traffic days. But at the same time, we don't have enough money. We don't have $200 million to go build a bypass. We don't have a couple hundred million to now go widen the highway. So this is now back to how do we manage those expectations in the long term, knowing that we're going to have some bad conditions once in a while during the summer peaks. Did that answer your question, Ian? Okay. Other questions? Okay, the other area that we wanted to hit a little bit was the small increase in traffic. Again, the legislature said, ODOT, you need to think about small changes to land use plans that don't have big traffic increases and not try to take those applications through the full TPR menu of processes. The legislature put in more in terms of make sure you are not requiring a high level of traffic analysis when it's not really needed or warranted. So what we've done is modified a policy in the Oregon Highway Plan called Policy 1F5 that talks about when you're making changes to your comprehensive plan, we can now have what we call small increases in traffic without having to go through the full TPR process. This, and I'm just going to jump right to what the standards are. So let's go. The bottom line out of this is we can now have, through our policies, small increases up to 400 trips per day. So if your proposed land use was going to generate 1,000 trips and the new land use you want to propose, your comprehensive plan amendment is going to be 1,399, close enough. We're not going to argue. You start figuring that out and spread it out on the system. You can't measure it anyway. So it's not a big deal. We'll deal with it through the normal local development review processes, site review processes. If there's an ODOT approachway permit, we'll deal with it that way. So all roads can have up to 400 additional trips for any given application. If you're on a facility that's a little bit bigger, we have a great a sliding scale. So if you're on a facility that's a five-lane facility of a certain general ADT, and I can't remember the exact ADT, I can pull it out, that increase can go clear up to 1,000. So it's pretty much a sliding scale depending on your roadway geometry and your traffic characteristics on the roadway. Basically what this is getting to is if you are not having a substantial increase onto the system, we're not going to worry about that during the land use process, the TPR process, the local development review processes, permitting processes can pick that up. These numbers were not pulled out of the air. This is actually tied directly to another piece of legislation that was moving through at exactly the same time on access management. Whereas we were dealing with permitting issues, the same issue about traffic analysis and putting some of the smaller developers through the ringer as they were being portrayed to go through permitting, we use the exact same thresholds here. So these are based upon the same kind of scientific background and mentality that came out of that process. But again, the goal here is if it's just adding a little bit of traffic, let's not try to go through a big exercise. The concern that really brought this up is back to the no further degradation. We had a policy that talked about if we had a facility that was operating at capacity or over the mobility standard or target or was projected to, the goal was to avoid further degradation. But what does avoid further degradation mean? We had different policy interpretations going across the state, anywhere from down to, yeah, a reasonable amount of traffic is fine, down to one additional trip is further degrading. We had all ends of the spectrum. This is to at least put a consistent policy construct to how we'll implement this across the state. So I hit this pretty quick because I really want to turn it over to Bill on some of the TPR changes, but any other questions on either of these parts?
Let me get that microphone over to you here.
This is now part of the definition for no for avoiding further degradation.
Okay.
Judith.
I can't remember, so I think another part of the change, I'm not sure if it was in this part or not, but another one of the changes I thought had to do with how what the assumptions are on new development no longer being required to assume the reasonable worst case, but something more average? Is that here or is that in the TPR section? TPR section?
It's not in the TPR. It's embedded a little bit in here as well as some other portions of the highway plan. It's not really a specific policy of the Oregon Highway Plan anywhere in there. It just talks about, you know, trying to compare things in apples to apples kind of a fashion.
Thank you, Eric. We'll have Eric in the audience when we get to the discussion section, but I have to pull him back up again if you guys have more questions on this front. At this point, let's hand it off to Bill Holmstrom. He's going to talk about the TPR amendments and specifically about the multimodal mixed-use area provision that's in the amendments. We'll get Bill hooked up over there.
Can you hear me? That sounds good. Okay, thank you. My name is Bill Holmstrom. I'm with the Transportation Growth Management Program with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I'm going to go kind of quickly over some of the changes to the TPR. I'm just going to go do a quick overview. I think most of the folks in this room understand the basics. If you don't, we can ask questions about it. The TPR, it is one of the rules that's adopted by LCDC. It's not an ODOT rule. It has transportation in the name, but it's actually implements Goal 12 of the statewide planning goals, so it's under the LCDC's jurisdiction. There's a lot of different rules within the transportation planning rules, and a lot of them have to do with how you do your transportation system planning. We're mostly going to be talking about 0060 today, which only deals with when you are amending a comprehensive plan or amending a land use regulation, including your zoning map. So that's the kind of thing we're going to be talking today. I know this whole session is about your TSP, and this doesn't necessarily affect that, but I think there are things that you need to keep in mind because of the changes we made to 0060 when you're working on your TSP. So that's what we're going to talk about today. So, like I think most folks in here know, when you do an action, make a land use amendment, or plan amendment, or a land use regulation change, a zone change, you have to determine whether or not that action would result in a significant effect on the transportation system. And if you determine that there will be a significant effect, there's lots of different ways of getting around that. I'm not going to get too detailed about that, except that we do have several new tools available. And some of these are what we're going to be talking about today. Just move on to the next slide. So there are a lot of different changes, little tweaks here and there. The biggest things are these three new sections that are under 0060, 9, 10, and 11. I'm going to have one slide each on 9 and 11, and then I'm going to get into section 10, which talks about the MMAs, and talk a little bit more detail about that. So section 9, what it does is it allows local governments to rezone your land as long as that rezone is consistent with an underlying comprehensive plan designation. So a lot of jurisdictions out there, you probably have a two-map system where you've got the underlying comprehensive plan designation, and then within each of those plan designations, you have multiple different zones to implement that plan. What this section does is says, hey, if you've got a zone change and it's consistent, it's under that same plan designation. You don't need to change your comprehensive plan designation. And it's something that you've already assumed in your TSP in terms of what might happen there. You can do that without even going to determine if you don't even need to determine if there's going to be a significant effect. You don't even need to take that step. So it makes it a little bit easier if you've got that all figured out. So I think the implications here for your TSP development are looking at your comprehensive plan designations and seeing if in the future you think you're going to be making some zone changes, making sure that your TSP and the assumptions for your land uses under that are consistent with what you might want to be doing in the future. So you don't get caught in the future with this whole consistent with the TSP and having to make a bigger deal out of a rezone than you might have wanted to otherwise. So let's go ahead and go talk about Section 11 briefly. Section 11 allows local governments to approve amendments with partial mitigation of a significant effect. This is for specific economic development purposes, and in the metro area, these things are zone changes, essentially that would allow traded sector or industrial uses, okay? So, and there's a couple different caveats there. I'm not going to get into the details of that, but if you have a zone change like that and you determine that there is a significant effect, what we are saying is there are opportunities to do a partial mitigation of those significant effects rather than mitigating the entire significant effect. And the mechanics of how we're going to do that are going to be worked out in each specific thing, each specific action, and there's a balancing test, and there's a lot of different little pieces to that that I'm not going to talk about today, but if you've got questions, you can ask later. So anticipating those kind of issues in the TSP, you may help avoid dealing with those Section 11 issues in the future. So let's get into the main event here, talking about Section 10, which is our multimodal mixed-use areas. I have to make sure I don't get those two mixed around. So what multimodal mixed-use areas are did I talk about this? I don't want to get too far ahead of my slides here. So what this section does, it allows a local government to, through a normal post-acknowledgement plan amendment that you would submit anytime you're doing a plan amendment, to adopt a MMA. So this isn't something that the state says, yes, you can have your MMA. This is something a local government makes a decision about and says, we adopt the MMA. The MMAs are densely developed areas, like your town centers, your downtowns, or main streets. They have distinct boundaries. Let's go to the next slide. So I think what the MMA gets you, once you've designated that MMA, you as a local government don't have to consider auto congestion performance standards when you're doing an upzoning. That's consistent with the MMA designation. So the goal of this is just one of the things that came out of our legislative mandate was we want to provide incentive for town centers development. We want to provide incentive for upzoning in those areas. We want to provide incentive for that dense, like I said, pedestrian-oriented development. You still have to consider other performance standards. So we've talked a lot today about different performance standards. Most of what we've got right now, right, are those vehicular auto congestion standards that the MMA says you don't have to deal with anymore. So if we're moving forward and talking about our TSPs in the future and other performance standards that we're going to be looking at when we do plan amendments in or outside of MMAs, those are something you want to keep an think about, especially in MMAs, because those are things you're going to still have to consider in those areas. So it applies to map or text amendments within the boundary. So I think when setting those boundaries, you have to keep in mind that any change within that boundary affects any of the system around it. So you don't have to consider standards even on facilities outside of the boundary, and vice versa. You have a change outside the boundary, you do have to consider the standards even inside the boundary. So that's something to think about. So in order to get a MMA, this is kind of, there's a couple things in your packet that talk about this. There's the checklist in there, as well as, you know, a copy of the rule itself, and that table that I just saw for the first time today, which talks about kind of the comparison between the Metro Title VI, is that right, and the MMA requirements. These are the kinds of things that you have to have in order to get MMA designated. I think it's important to remember this is a statewide rule, so these things don't necessarily match exactly with your requirements in your 2040 town centers, but that's because we wrote it for any jurisdiction in the state to be able to implement them. Next slide. So here's a slide I kind of put in here for this presentation. 2040 centers, gosh, these are really the kind of places we'd like to see the MMAs implemented if your jurisdiction would like to do that. you don't automatically meet the MMA requirements. If you've done a lot of the planning, a lot of the work, a lot of things you need to do to meet the Title VI requirements, you're well on your way. You probably, there's a good chance you meet them, but you do need to go through again and review those requirements that are in the rule to make sure that you meet those. And then the last thing, you know, I put down there is, like I said before, if you're looking at other performance standards in your TSP, you want to make sure that that's something, you want it to apply in the MMA, you need something other than those auto congestion standards. So within a quarter mile of the freeway interchange, if you've got, your boundary is going to get that close to a freeway interchange, and I know in the metro area there's a lot of places where we have our town centers that are pretty close to a freeway interchange or include a freeway interchange or multiple freeway interchanges, you have to coordinate with the mainline facility provider, which in almost every case is ODOT. They have to consider certain specific operational and safety factors. They're somewhat limited in what they are allowed to consider in terms of what the rule actually lays out. If those effects that you and the facility provider believe would come out of that designation, the goal here isn't to say, no, you can't have your MMA. The goal is to say, okay, so these are the effects that we think are going to happen sometime in the future. Let's continue to measure those. Let's figure out what actions would be required to mitigate those in the future when we hit those, and let's write this all down in an agreement ahead of time so that we all are on the same page about how this is going to handle. So I think that's the direction we're going with how these are going to be implemented, to kind of have that all figured out before the MMA gets implemented, and then ODOT or whoever the facility provider is would sign off on that and provide that written concurrence saying, you guys can go forward with your MMA. So if you've got a town center that doesn't necessarily meet every single requirement of the MMA, you can actually make that plan or land use regulation change at the same time you designate the MMA, and you don't have to consider the auto congestion standards at that time. So one of my last slides here, I just want to kind of say this is a bigger decision about your community values and the balance in your community. This is something you need to talk very carefully with your policymakers about before deciding to go ahead with implementing or designating the MMA. Our current status quo up until now has been, you know, we have performance standards that look at traffic congestion standards, right? And so when you've got a standard and you're measuring something, that's what you're going to get. That's going to be your only value that you're looking at. So I think we're moving into an era now where we're looking at, that's not the only thing that's important to our community. So, and we've talked about that a lot today. This gives us another tool to say we want to look at other factors. We have other values in our community. And this can help implement those values and make it easier to develop those urban centers the way we want to say it's not just important to have mobility for automobiles, but we want to have these other community values expressed in our transportation system as well. So I guess my other point is start planning now. Don't wait for something to come along before you implement it and make that be the driver of making a decision about whether or not you want to do an MMA or not.
So Bill, I was going to actually ask you on that point. Sure. I believe that you've heard from a few local jurisdictions that are exploring this already, and maybe you could rattle those off to your knowledge at this point, just for the benefit of people knowing who's up to this right now.
Right. So our first submission we've seen at the agency is the city of Lake Oswego. Is anyone from Lake Oswego here? Oh, congratulations. So actually, the very first one in the whole state that we've seen, the only one
so far. Cutting edge.
And we've got a couple of jurisdictions that are interested at some level or another and are moving forward and have applied for grants, and we may see in the near to medium future. But that's the only one that we've seen at the agency so far.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Lake Oswego Town Center, and they're incorporating their new Foothills District into that. And it's a MMA will be a, it's a tool to help them bring that in.
And kind of along those lines, one thing that when the metro region was talking about this during the rulemaking process last year, MPAC raised the question about, well, how do we know if our neighboring jurisdiction is seeking an MMA on the joint facility that we both rely on? And so what we've committed to do at Metro is work with DLCD to track these as they're coming in and then periodically report that to MPAC. So that'll be the place that we periodically say, hey, you know what, Lake Oswego has submitted for an MMA, here's kind of what it looks like, and then be able to point people to that, since there's not really a notice requirement beyond what you do for a comprehensive plan update, and not something you probably pick up otherwise. So that's going to be our best effort, since we all are up against our neighbors here and sharing a lot of the facilities that would be affected by this.
Yeah, and any time you do a plan amendment, you know, there's a on the DLCD form, there's a part where you can say the other affected local jurisdictions, and we encourage you to put your neighboring cities, metro, everyone on there, just so that everyone gets that notification. At least that level of notification, hopefully more coordination than that.
So questions for Bill, and then I'm going to have the panel come on. We'll discuss this in a little bit more detail. Yeah, in the very back, I'm going to come back with a microphone.
Yeah.
I'll get back there.
I think of some town centers on the periphery of the region that don't have really good transit service. I think of like Bethany, Cedar Mill, maybe East County, East Multnomah County, where there are transit stops, but, you know, sometimes it's just peak hour service or, you know, only Monday through Friday. Are there any further guidance on transit stops, or you just need to have transit stops?
The rule is nebulous because I think, again, it's aimed at the entire state. So there are communities out there that could feasibly implement this that don't even have transit. In fact, it says if transit service is available, a transit stop in the MMA. And that's what the rule says. Ideally, in the metro area, you'd have frequent service transit in any place that you would consider to be an MMA. I think it would probably be pretty tough for us to come out and make you do it that way, but that's what the rule says. Read the rule, and like I said, it's pretty broad in those terms.
And I think in our region, the answer is that if you are a 2040 town center, you may not have super great transit now, but part of the regional plan is to get that transit improved over time. So that's all goes back to that template for transit that's in the RTP. So that's where I think for us, we've done a lot of our homework on this for those kinds of questions. And if you've already done your 2040 base planning for your town center or regional center, you probably have checked all these boxes already on some level.
Yes. So your question was, does the MMA have to be in one of those 2040 town centers, regional centers, or Main Street corridor? I think that's where it makes sense. I think you've already kind of figured out that's where it makes sense. But the state law does not require that. State law is very flexible about that. It has to be within the UGB, and it has to meet the requirements that an MMA has. So I think it's feasible and possibly likely that there are places in the metro area that meet those minimum requirements that are not one of those areas. I think they fit together very well, and I think that makes sense for where they are, but not required.
Yeah, and I think in our region there are a scattering of main streets and neighborhood centers that would meet the state definition that weren't picked up on the 2040 map or just part of a local comp plan. So there's a few of them out there probably.
That's a great question. So the question was, how do MMAs relate to STAs, or special transportation areas? So when we were developing the rule, we talked a lot about that, and like, can we just use that instead of making a whole new thing? The issue is STAs are on state highways. They're a segment of state highways, so they're a linear thing, when what we wanted to capture was, we're talking about land use amendments, which generally are rezonings, which talk about a polygon or a parcel or an area, which aren't necessarily attached to a state highway. So we wanted to be a little bit broader about that. So that's why we have areas that within that you can do zone changes. And the STAs just talk about a segment of highway. And the MMAs don't just, you know, it's not just the state facilities that they affect, it's all the local facilities too. So that's why we weren't able to use that tool for both.
So, Lidveen, you raised your hand. Let's have the panel come on back up because
sure.
We're going to get into more discussion on this, and that's a great one for Lidveen to weigh in on.
It's and then, absolutely true, though, that like it's a good if you've got a state highway running through a place that is an MMA, that seems like a really good candidate for an STA for the kinds of things that the STA gets you in terms of your access management and your other state. You know, facility issues that you have along those corridors, it makes a lot of sense. They could. Not, I think at this point, ODOT would be looking, I mean, I'll maybe let Lidveen talk, but
yeah. I want to talk about the STA in the metro area and what an STA does and doesn't do. So apart from the fact that an STA is a linear thing along a highway and an MMA is a roundish thing, blobish thing,
clearly defined.
Oh, sorry. With a clear boundary, whatever shape that boundary might be. And an STA requires OTC adoption, which an MMA doesn't. But the main thing an STA does, well, there's three things it does. And one is that it changes mobility standards. Well, that doesn't apply in the Portland metro area because we have a different set of mobility standards that are tied to 2040 centers and not to STAs. So the difference is in the Oregon Highway Plan, Table 6 applies everywhere in the state except Portland metro, and it'll have a VC value, 0.85, et cetera, and it's different inside an STA from outside an STA. In the Portland area, we don't have that. We have a set of mobility standards that apply in town centers, regional centers, et cetera, and a different set on corridors and industrial areas. So that doesn't buy you anything, becoming an STA in the Portland metro area. In order to avail yourself of the mobility standards that apply to centers, so if you're not going to do an MMA, you have to meet the standards in the Urban Growth Management Functional Plan, Title 6, that says you have to have a boundary and you have to allow the mix and density of uses in Title 6 of the Growth Management Functional Plan. But there's a couple other things. The characteristics of an STA are very similar between an MMA and Title 6 and an STA. But the STA has two other things. One is highway design standards. So you may still want an STA if you want to avail yourself of those highway design standards. And the other thing is access management standards. And this is something you want to think about. An STA favors local street connections over private driveways. It really does not. Like you're not supposed to have driveways in STAs. You're supposed to have private public streets at the spacing that the rest of your, you know, that your town center has. So we just had a conversation this morning about an STA on TV Highway. Well, are your property owners willing to live with that access management restriction? You know, probably not the length of TV Highway, and maybe in a small area. The other thing about an STA is it does allow designating an STA where those characteristics are planned rather than all in place. But it discourages designating STAs where there isn't already a Main Street center type situation. We really don't want new STAs straddling a highway and encourage having it either perpendicular or, you know, focused on a parallel street. If it's Sandy or Sisters or, you know, or even Lake Oswego or what, it's already there, and the SDA is a tool for managing the highway consistent with what's already there. But we really do not encourage having that kind of density and that kind of expectation and of people wanting to cross the highway where it's not already the case. So you may not get an SDA even if you, you know, qualify for an MMA designation based on that consideration.
So we've got a couple of questions. John, you're going to hit that side. I'll come over here and hit you, John, next. Vinny, you want to take that one?
Yeah, we actually are processing an application that's possibly going to use Section 11. It's for industrial development, and we're trying to figure out that the balancing test in Section 11 is that the economic benefits in terms of traded sector industrial jobs outweigh the transportation impacts. And those are apples and oranges, so this is very uncomfortable for us. You know, ODOT, we know all about transportation impacts, but we don't know what's economic benefit. So in the rule, it specifies that the local jurisdiction who makes the plan amendment decisions has to work with Business Oregon, and in, like, Portland, you probably work with PDC, to establish the economic benefit. And you would do your traffic impact analysis, identify if there is significant impact, et cetera. And then you need ODOT concurrence for this partial mitigation if it's on a highway, or the city's concurrence if it's, you know, on a city street. So ODOT would work with Business Oregon to have that conversation. Do we think the economic benefits outweigh the transportation impacts? And it's not going to be necessarily, you know, we're not going to ask the city or the applicant to, like, translate jobs into dollars, or maybe, you know, you could do that, but it's not going to necessarily be that quantitative. And then once you've agreed that, yes, Section 11 applies, there is economic benefit here, so you qualify for partial mitigation, there's still the trick of, well, how much mitigation is good enough? And that will be negotiated on a case-by-case basis. It'll probably have something to do with rough proportionality, although that's not the words that are used in the rule. But, you know, something proportionate to the impacts on the facilities. So we're trying to figure this out as we get the applications in.
And is that application, I think you said there's an application in now, that's your first one, is that in our region? Okay, thank you. There we go. Okay.
But if I would just, I would point out one thing on that. We're here today talking about the transportation system planning, and I would just encourage everybody, when you're doing that system level, look around and figure out where those industrial and employment areas are and take care of it during the TSP process to figure out on a more system-wide scale, what do you need to do to accommodate that area? What are multiple funding sources? So that way you're not trying to deal with a single property owner, a single developer when they come in saying, well, I really want to get some jobs here, and you're having to have that discussion right then. Get it figured out ahead of time, and you'll never need to use Section 11 because you'll already have the zoning in place when they come knocking on your door. There's my little plug for planning ahead.
Getting back to MMA, so is there any minimum area requirement?
No.
Okay.
Practically speaking.
Well.
All right, other questions? Other questions on any of this material that you want to ask today?
Thank you.
Matt, do you want to do that one?
Sure. This is probably a good time for people to have the rule in front of them, and it's a packet that looks like this in there on the left side. And if you flip over, you'll see a section with a bunch of underline and strikeout to help you see what the changes were.
What page are you on there, Matt?
It's called page 1 of 8, but you have to flip to the second page to get
okay.
there.
Okay. So it's page 3, which is actually page 1 of 8, which is actually 11.
And towards the bottom there where it says, you'll see the 2, it says, if a local government determines there would be a significant effect, then, and there's a lot of options that follow. What do you do to make sure that things are consistent? It's not a death sentence just because you determine there is a significant effect. And flipping over to the page 2 of 8, you'll see that list of A, B, C, D. And one that's new that I think perhaps Mara wanted to draw our attention to was the section E. It talks about benefits to other modes, benefits to or facilities other than the significant affected facility, or improvements at other locations. This is more options for how you would deal with a rezoning and the effect that it might have. Maybe it's a parallel route. Maybe it's the upstream and downstream intersections are the place to do it. Maybe what's really needed here is much better pedestrian crossings. That's really a better issue at this intersection than dual left turn lanes. Is that most of what you wanted to look at, or were there other specific things? Oh, okay. Flipping back a page in section 1, which is the definition of a significant effect, we made what may be a significant change to that definition to say, if you do TDM, or what we actually call it, let's see, what do we call it? Enforceable ongoing requirements that would demonstrably limit traffic generation, including but not limited to transportation demand management. If the amendment includes those kinds of things, you get to take that off the top. Before you do any VC analysis, before you do any level of service, before you try to figure out where the trip distribution is, just look and say, well, maybe the new zone doesn't actually generate any more trips because we're doing these kinds of TDM things, and you could skip a lot of other analysis because you never make that finding of significant effect.
So I wanted to back up to a question that I sort of answered because we didn't have the panel back up here and give Steve a chance to weigh in on this issue of we've got these 2040 centers out there. They've been doing all the good planning in their local plans. And then John opened up by saying, you know, here's our challenge. We're still growing, but our transit service hasn't been. So what's TriMet's perspective when we've got planned transit on the ground, maybe a bus stop, and MMA comes forward as a local action? Is that something that you would agree with my comment that the long term is that we plan to have the transit there and a higher level of service, but for now it is what it is?
Yes, I think that's probably the best way to look at it. I think we'd want to certainly have some focused discussion about just to confirm what other, you know, with the MMA, what are there other changes in the nature of the area itself that might be considerations too? But I think we'd want to keep things in sync, try to make sure that and if there's any timing or horizon considerations as far as the development itself, or if there's something else behind the MMA that's we'd want to be aware of, we'd take that into account as well. I think fundamentally we don't want to preclude the implementation of expanded improved service in the time frame that we'd like to, that it, you know, where the warrants are there, the ridership is there. We want to be able to get the good service, the improved service there in that same time frame and not have design constraints or other development constraints, the connectivity constraints that might handicap the success of the service and serving as many trips as we can. So all part of it.
And if all goes well with the MMA, you'll have that demand for the service. And I think I haven't looked at the scale-back system on this level, but we certainly have been covering at a basic service level all of the 2040 centers of Main Street. So they shouldn't fall off the system entirely, but I haven't looked at the scale-back service that closely either. So there may be places that are either developing centers or planned centers. Some of the dots are planned centers that actually have lost service entirely. I'm not sure of that question. That's another issue for us. We may have to think about that here. In my mind, that's the purpose of the RTP, to line up that commitment to service, especially if you can show that the development pattern itself is going to make that feasible. So other questions or comments? Anything you want to bring up on anything we talked about today for the panel? Scott, let me turn this over to you.
John. Just a question about tying these two together. So on the Oregon Health Plan, there was this WEDA.5, this small region, and it says on the slide it's implementing the TPR. So what specific TPR piece is it implementing?
I'm going to leave this to Eric and Levine.
It applies to 060.
And Matt.
Right, so what part of 060 do you are to implement?
It's the performance standard. So every jurisdiction, and that's cities, counties, and state, has to define what the performance standard is going to be for their facilities. And part of defining a performance standard is defining what's the threshold. And that's part of how ODOT and the commission has said this is going to be our performance and this is one of our thresholds.
And beyond that, I think it really just ties to the significant effect definition, that if you're within those thresholds, it's not classified as a significant effect. That's really the implementation piece, as I would interpret that.
And maybe to tie it to our topic today, which is transportation system planning in the local governments in Metro, when you're updating your TSP, it's a good time to be really clear what is your performance standard and what is your threshold. It sounds basic, but I've read a lot of TSPs throughout the state where you can't really tell what is the local performance standard, be it congestion or safety or anything else. It's maybe implied, or they sort of work around it, but never come right and say, for our system, this is how we will measure performance. So I would encourage, when you're doing your updates, do that.
All right, I'm going to put Kim and Levine on the spot here. How many STAs did we designate in our region back when the RTP was adopted and whatever the heck that was? 12 to 15, okay. Does everybody know where your neighborhood STA is located? All right, there's something to check right there. So I think a key point here, and that Levine made, is that STAs are all about the design aspects of your Main Street if it's owned by the state. And so take a look at that, see where your STA boundaries are. It may not match where you think your MMA boundary is, so that would be a good thing to talk to ODOT about and say, listen, let's talk about this, because our land use ambitions outsize our STA on this map that we're looking at right here.
Not all of the areas that wanted to become an STA were approved through that process. So there are some 2040 centers or main streets or other locations that considered it, but were not approved that we can identify.
All right. So if you have a state-owned facility in your town center, regional center, main street, station community, corridor, 2040 corridor, actually not corridors, just Main Street, station communities, and centers, it would qualify for the STA. So something to think about, and unlike the MMA, which is going to be a local action following the rule, the STA is something you'll work with ODOT to designate. Any more questions? I was hoping somebody would ask about that part of it. Here we go.
Similar question, boundary question on MMAs. I heard something new that I hadn't heard before, which is if there's a standard outside of MMA and there's a change going on outside the MMA, that would apply in the MMA, and the other way around. If something changes in the MMA, you get the more lenient standard outside the MMA. That sounds problematic if I'm understanding it right. So I'm wondering, how do you define where the boundary of the MMA is? Do you get to put a buffer in there or something?
I think you're describing the STA, actually, not the MMA. For an MMA, it's a polygon, and if the zone change is inside that polygon, then the MMA applies. regardless of where the traffic impacts might occur. If the zone change is outside the MMA, then none of these MMA rules have anything to do with it, and that zone change is going to be handled under the standard TPR 060 rules, including you have to consider whether it has impacts on the roads inside the MMA. Those are still, the performance standards still apply. An STA is actually almost the opposite in that once you change, well, I guess in Metro it doesn't really change the performance standards very much on that segment of highway, but if the zone change could be a quarter mile away from the STA, the performance standards of the STA still apply within the STA.
Okay, did that answer your question? Okay.
Did I just make it more confusing?
No, we got a head nod back there. Any other questions, comments? Anything you want to just rail about with all this stuff?
We got another one here. Okay.
Follow-up question.
You did answer that one.
Okay. Still MMA question. So if you have an area that meets TPR, you've found that you're compliant with TPR, is there any reason to go get an MMA? Is there a benefit to that? An idea in my mind would be there's limited funding. We talked about that a lot. Would Metro be scoring you higher for some grant if you have an MMA?
I think the short answer is no, that we're mostly going to see cities and counties designating MMAs because they have in mind something they want to upzone. There's some development that they want to do and they're concerned they might not be able to. In the case of Lake Oswego, we understand it's the foothills area. There's a desire to upzone some of that, so by designating the MMA, then you've set the stage for some future upzonings in that area.
Well, actually, I would say in the rulemaking process last year, I served on the Rural Advisory Committee, and when we looked at our region, I think the ironic part of this is the places that need the MMA most are also the ones right near interchanges. And it makes sense when you think about it. Those tend to be bottlenecks where there's freeway access and then a bunch of economic activity. We happen to have loaded up transit lines right on those freeways, so we have a bunch of station communities near those interchanges. So I think in many cases in the MMA process, you'll be walking through the ODOT discussion to figure out those implications as well, figure out what your agreement with ODOT is going to look like. But those are the places where the system is so full that you probably can't get to your land use ambitions without trying to use this avenue. In places that are away from the freeways, you're much less likely to have the system that full and probably less likely to have a state facility involved.
So, Tom, I wanted to add another really good example of a potential future MMA is in the downtown Oregon City Regional Center. Recently, the paper mill closed down, and this is a prime piece of could be just amazing redevelopment. It's right next to Willamette Falls. There's a lot of potential for very, very much of a mixed-use development with some parks as well. Won't get into the details of that. However, we're right next to the I-205/99E interchange, which has significant limitations and to make improvements to increase the capacity of it are not at all reasonable. So this is a prime example of when you would go for the MMA and show the not just economic value, but the ability to do a lot of infill within the metro region and the ability to probably have some recreational benefits, all kinds of benefits that could come from this. But there will be impacts on the transportation system. So we wouldn't even be able to consider it doing... They wouldn't be able to consider doing this big infill if there wasn't some sort of a vehicle like this.
So we've had conversations with several jurisdictions around the region about this MMA thing and what are we supposed to do to get it. And you heard the first part. It's your decision. We don't grant anything. We don't bless it. You do need our concurrence if the MMA boundary is within a quarter mile of an interchange. You do need to actually work with us, even if it's not, and even if it's not a freeway that you're considering an MMA with, because we still have a responsibility to look at the safety impacts of an MMA designation. And just like any other post-acknowledgement plan amendment, we will be checking those DLCD notices, but we would hope to be talking to you well before it gets to the notice of a final hearing about any MMA you're considering. And the agreement, our expectation for this process is that there be some analysis of safety impacts. Our main concern is backups on freeway off-ramps, and that requires some traffic analysis. However, we are concerned about safety throughout the MMA for all modes. So the agreement that might come out of that conversation could include agreed upon improvements, you know, pedestrian crossings or bicycle improvements. It's not our expectation that the agreement will only be about the interchange itself and the backups on the interchange. Obviously we haven't done this yet. This is a brand new provision, but it is likely that it's difficult when you're doing an MMA designation. There is no development being proposed, so you can't do a before and after, you know, TPR kind of analysis. So one thing that we're thinking is that you would do your future forecast based on whatever is in your comp plan now, using the population and employment that's, you know, right now, like in our region, the one that's just been agreed upon for the gamma version of the pop and employment. Don't spend a lot of time trying to do a future forecast of post-MMA conditions, because you have no way of knowing what they are. But in the agreement, set some measures for monitoring conditions, and that could be not VC, but you know, certain crash rates, or if the queue exceeds a certain length, or I don't know what it's going to be. It depends where it is and what it looks like out there. But think in terms of monitoring and triggers that when certain things are reached, then certain improvements might have to be put in place, or certain programs might have to be put in place, like reducing parking if you get to a certain volume, or, you know, something to make this. The whole idea about MMAs is to reduce driving and encourage walking, biking, and using transit. So the agreement about an MMA could include making those things in your plans to actually make it possible to walk from outside areas to the MMA and within the MMA, safe, convenient, et cetera, to actually put those in place. So don't think it's definitely about off-ramp, you know, backups on the on-ramp, but it is about the whole package that makes this an MMA. And in your findings, you can point to all these great bike and ped improvements that you've got and transit that you've got planned for your MMA, but if none of them actually happen, you know, it's not going to turn out the way you thought. So you can set up triggers for the actual development, not just plan amendments in the future, but actual development of permitted uses to put in place some of those things that are in your plan for the other modes that make an MMA an MMA, a multimodal mixed-use area.
So I have a question, Levine, kind of following up with that, because you were talking about through the agreement. So you're really referencing when concurrency or letter of concurrence is necessary, so really within an interchange area, for example. Although some of the things you're saying would be a good idea just anyway, but it might not be through a negotiated agreement with ODOT necessarily. Is that correct?
I'm saying we will still get notice of proposed MMA. It's a plan amendment like any other. Mm-hmm. Enter into that conversation. Mm-hmm. It's just that we're in a less powerful position because we don't need our concurrence.
Right.
So and we'll have to ask pretty please.
and so after that clarification, then what does it mean, or how is ODOT thinking about what it means to plan for a facility that is within an MMA that's, you know, outside the area of an interchange, for example, as far as funding, as far as prioritization? Obviously, there's still a standard, a state standard for a facility within an MMA is that going to impact the way ODOT thinks about prioritization and funding for improvements?
No idea, but I know there's nothing in the STIP criteria about MMAs.
Do you want me to read the disclaimer? That when doing this amendment, there was some concern about that, the thought that, well, if a local government makes an MMA and it gets a lot of congestion and then comes back and says, hey, we need state money to fix this congestion, that would be probably an inconsistent thing. So there was a section added. It's on page 2 of the rules as part of section 2 that says a local government using some of these different sections to an approved amendment recognizes that additional motor vehicle traffic congestion may result and that other facility providers, that'd be like the county and ODOT, would not be expected to provide additional capacity for motor vehicles in response to this congestion. As Bill was talking about, this is an important community-level policy decision to be making, values.
But certainly that facility isn't ignored by the service provider in the future.
No, it's not ignored, but we don't have a mechanism to elevate it in any of our processes. Now, some of the things we're doing with the new STIP might, you know, fit very well when we're starting to talk about enhancing the system and multimodal enhancements and linking transit and bike and ped systems better might actually lend itself towards those things. But, you know, as Livian's talking about, one of the things we really just want to have the conversation about, do you have in your plan the things necessary to help make that MMA be successful? Are you prioritizing those projects in your system plan, you know, to make sure that those are going to be some of the first things that happen so you have the infrastructure and the safety elements to really promote the kinds of activities there that you're wanting to see? And I think that's really what we're talking about in these dialogues. It's a communication. It's a partnership. It's not a top-down thing. It's just, let's make sure we thought about this holistically and you have the pieces in place, whether it's local funding or even talking about how you can compete for some of those state resources through the new processes.
So to summarize that point then, trying to think what this looks like for the local government, it sounds to me like they call their Region 1 ODOT planning staff, Vidveen, and say, we're thinking about this MMA thing, and now we understand there's going to be some kind of agreement or something with ODOT that actually should be an exhibit to our land use action when we get to that point. So even before Matt's folks hear about this, they probably got that in hand. They've already worked that out with ODOT. So that's the flow we're talking about here. And that's if you fall under the provisions that TPR lays out. So not all MMAs, but take a good look if you're anywhere near an interchange or on one in many cases. John, you had a question in the very back.
The coordination should occur in all cases as a discussion.
Yes. Yes. Oh, okay. Yeah, go ahead, Jim. Yeah.
Well, I was on the rulemaking committee, and I pushed pretty hard to keep this opportunity, what I consider to be fairly clear for cities like Tigard. We have a lot of interchanges. At the same time, it's a pretty big deal to completely just waive, you know, everything that we've been using up until now. And so the hope, for me, the hope is that it, instead of just being something that completely ties our hands, it becomes something we can work with. And so I think, for example, so I have not been wanting to race to be the first person, the first agency that does one, quite frankly. But one of the things I think maybe that we will want to consider is, do we want to make sure that we have in place more specific performance measures and mitigation requirements, because we won't be leaning on the state to impose that. But, you know, the second, perhaps, let's just say, for example, maybe the second biggest issue that we've been dealing with is trying to open up some opportunities for economic development. But what do you think the first issue is? Traffic congestion. So let's not, you know, I want to be pretty thoughtful about moving forward in a way that I might be sorry if I got my way. So one of the things that I would think about is perhaps not oversizing an MMA, you know, really knowing where I want that flexibility, because I don't think that you're going to be able to take it back from a property owner. So that's, I just wanted to say that as much as I pushed for this opportunity, I want to be cautious with it too.
Yeah, and just one thing you reminded me of is the only thing the MMA relieves the local government jurisdiction the responsibility of going through the TPR 060, determining if there's a significant effect. You can implement your own rules about what you do when there's a land use amendment on top of all your regular site design and all those other regulations that you've still got. I mean, those are all still there. So you don't have to throw everything out if you don't want to. It allows you to, but you don't have to.
And just one more quick add-on to that. The conversation's kind of gone to conforming use applications, I think, not just rezones. That's what I'm kind of hearing. The other aspect I would suggest you think about is design projects. When you're building improvements on state highways, it's not the highway plan, it's the design manual. So when you're doing your MMA-type things and thinking about ultimate performance measures, you could think about getting a planning-level design exception at the same time so you don't hit a stumbling block when you go to build improvements on the highway.
I heard it. I don't think that'd be it yet. Go ahead.
Thanks. I thought that's what you said, but I wasn't sure if I heard it right. Yeah, so Region 1 sponsored this research, and Matt Huhart was in the room. I don't know if he still is. He was a primary investigator for that. So we came up with some potential measures, like a menu of measures that you might want to consider. And they're not all for mobility. So real quick, under mobility, we looked at non-SOV mode share, which is a metro performance standard, travel time, multimodal level of service, and then primarily the bike-ped element of that, VMT and delay, especially on the freight network. We also looked at reliability, and the recommended measure was 80 percentile travel time index. I'm still having a hard time understanding these reliability measures and our ability to actually measure them. We looked at cost of congestion, and that did not. At hours of congestion, and that did not show up as the recommended measure. But that was another one we thought about. Accessibility, and that can be to whatever is important to certain key destinations, to transit, to the bike network. The beauty of accessibility is that you can apply it to plan amendments because when you change the number of households to a fixed destination, then your accessibility goes up. And when you change, for instance, you add transit, then your accessibility to transit and keep the households constant, your accessibility also goes up. So you can improve on that measure, both by improving the network or adding density. Safety, and we looked at a critical rate, like a bar above which, you know, something is triggered, and also excess proportion of certain types of crashes, like if you have all rear end or sideswipe or a lot of bike ped accident crashes. On the infrastructure side, we looked at a percent complete measure for bike ped infrastructure because one of the basic concepts of the RTP policy framework is this notion of completeness, and unfortunately, our street systems are fairly complete, but they're not complete for all modes. So looking at what's the percent of the bike ped part of the network that's complete, and I'm saying the network, not just the street. You have your bike plan, you have your ped plan. It may be on street, it may include trails, it may be the arterials, it may be a parallel, you know, bike boulevard or whatever. So have your network planned and then measure what percent of that's in place, and that includes crossings, because it doesn't do you any good if you have a sidewalk on one of the, even on both sides of the street, but you can't get from one to the other. Intersection density, tons of pollutants generated, and then equity, like some of those accessibility measures, look at them specifically for certain subgroups of the population. And then we looked at which of the, these are measures that you can apply to your plan, to your TSP. Not all of these measures lend themselves to plan amendments. So there's probably stuff you can do with accessibility, with system completeness, something about safety, like if there is a high crash location, you know, you could mitigate that and as part of plan amendments.
I'm going to thank Eric for asking you that question in this forum, so I can first of all tell you I'm going to put you on the TPAC agenda so we can get that in more detail, and then also ask if we can either link to the resource on our TSP page or even make it directly available there, because I think that's be nice to have just as a tool out there for everybody. Thanks. That's very interesting. Actually, I was going to ask a question of our two consultants on the panel here. Have you two been hearing about MMAs and STAs from local jurisdictions and their scoping? Is this something that they is on their radar and that they would like to accomplish in their TSP update?
Yeah, it's actually kind of come up partway through the TSP process, so not in the scoping process, but because the MMA requirements are, you know, new. It's become part of the discussion just recently, and it's an initial discussion we're having with one of the jurisdictions right now, and it can fold really nicely into the TSP update in the sense that they're probably pretty much there, as was described earlier, because they're a center in terms of the requirements they need to meet. But there are maybe one or two amendments that we need to make to local code. And look at this, we are making other amendments as part of the TSP update. So we can fold that all together in terms of the code amendments, and then as a separate process, there'll be the plan amendment to designate the boundary, and then the other process to be in negotiation and conversation with ODOT. But yeah, we're seeing an opportunity right now possibly arising with one of our TSP updates.
The answer is no. None of the TSPs we've been scoping have that as a component. I think it's just a timing thing because we've been doing this for, you know, a year plus, and these really haven't emerged until more recently. But we've certainly been talking to communities about them.
So in the rulemaking, there's a chicken and egg aspect. There's a TSP, which isn't always part of the comp plan. It's sometimes a separate document. And the comp plan probably is a place that this needs to happen. And so that's where I was just curious whether you had encountered that. But I think what you just described, Shana, in terms of that sequence, is probably how it would work out for most people. Whichever vehicle comes along first will be the one that becomes the vehicle, whether it's a comp plan update or a TSP or even just an area plan for a downtown that triggers it. The good part is it's a local activity. Call it a V before you get too far into it. All right. Yes, so let's try to finish a little bit early. One more question for the panel before we wrap up. Like a really stumping type question. No more questions? All right, so we'll have lots of stuff up on the website. John, talk about that a little bit maybe. Right. No, just thanks for coming in on a beautiful day. Go enjoy the rest of our extended summer. Hard to be in here on a day like today.
Thank you.
that actually work if they have relevant?
Fairview, she got a letter today. They didn't get it.
Oh. Well, I haven't been to the office today, so it's possible
maybe,
there.
Maybe.
What were they applying for?
Conforming land use.
They're great.
It's going to be, well, I saw you nodding when I said the thing about the scope of these TSPs is really growing.
We're doing a neighborhood, kind of a sub-area plan in Ashland, and it's fitting into the TSP context, which actually hasn't even been adopted yet. But there was all this multimodal service analysis.
I didn't fully hear the answer.
Carl's good question.
So you've got all these components about
TSPs.
Oh, in the scope.
Especially the multimodal stuff.
Right. Well, besides, they don't even know what it means.
Oh, my God, what a bitch.
I mean, nobody knows what it means yet, so what does it mean when you have
level service A,
or B, or C, or D?
And see, what we were finding was that
basically... or safety. A lot of cases, the location of the area near the development is beyond that. And you can't, and maybe you don't want them to mitigate it back to what the crystal ball is. What's your next goal?
That to me is that we don't know what we don't know, don't understand it.
Let's build some other pieces of the system and kind of bail our way out.
Almost like an maybe it's got to be an SPC thing.
I know, and I didn't want to, like, say it in front of his... I know, yeah, and I... That's my... Yeah, and I didn't want to, like... That's why I didn't say the name, and even though Nancy mentioned it, because Christina just brought it up to me in the meeting last week.
Well, yeah, no, I may have said it on the way here. But that's a pretty fast for big... Well, it actually allows... Well, you probably would have never other West Bank. Yeah,
yeah. They're
like, Beaverton's looking at it in the Creekside area right there on Canyon Road. That's one candidate. Well, yeah, you couldn't upzone Canyon Road very easily under the today's rules. Exactly. Talking about it, it's still kind of new and scary.
Yeah.
You know, they have areas that want to.